Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy, rants, raves, diatribes, even monologues from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartzschreiber, your host. On today's show, Bitcoin in the developing world. Can Bitcoin help entrepreneurs get the funding they need? Can it help economic woes like hyperinflation? Joining me to discuss this is Caleb Watney. He's a graduate research fellow at the Mercatus Center, a university-based research center. Caleb, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me on today.
So over the past, you know, 5 or so years, Bitcoin has gone from a geeky novelty to a legitimate currency. And while in the United States, where we have, you know, established banking institutions, it might not be as necessary, it's certainly helping out a lot of people in the developing world. Let's start with the basics, though. What the hell is Bitcoin?
Absolutely. I think the easiest way to think about Bitcoin is as digital cash. When you give $5 to your friend, you don't have to go through any third-party intermediary. You just hand him the cash, and then he has it. It works the same way with Bitcoin, but it allows us to transfer way over farther distances. So, Evan, if I were to give you a Bitcoin, you could be in Australia and I could be in the United States, and it would get to you instantly without going through any intermediary. And it's a lot more safe and secure and fast. And yeah, I think, as you mentioned, it has a lot of potential in the developing world.
And who is in control of Bitcoin? Because obviously a government currency is managed by the treasury of that country, you know, the United States Treasury for the US dollar. Who's in charge of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I think that's one of the beautiful aspects of Bitcoin is its decentralized nature. There's no single person or no single institution that holds too much sway over the Bitcoin network. Thousands and millions of people run the Bitcoin software on their computer, all helping use their computer's processing power to submit the nodes onto the blockchain, which solidifies it and make sure that everybody knows who has sent Bitcoin to who. So yeah, that answer your question, Evan, there is no single person or no single institution that owns Bitcoin.
All right, so how does Bitcoin help developing economies and the particular challenges that they face?
Yeah, well, one of the ways I like to think about it is in economics terms, we have marginal benefit and switching costs. So as you mentioned earlier, Bitcoin would definitely provide some advantages over our current economic currency. It would be faster to process transactions. It would be safer in some ways. But for the most part, our financial system here in the United States is pretty secure. Most people have savings accounts. Most people have access to credit. And the switching costs of switching our entire economy over to Bitcoin would be enormous. It would take a long time and be very expensive. But in the developing world, they really don't have a lot of the same, you know, financial sophistication as we do. Many of them don't have access to savings accounts. They have to rely on currencies that are way less stable than the United States dollar. I think that's one of the best ways it can help is it has a much higher marginal benefit for them, but a much lower switching cost.
Right, because the United States has such an established system, it really wouldn't make sense for us to go full blown towards Bitcoin. But in countries with really struggling currencies or really underdeveloped economies, this might be kind of a way of skipping that step of having established banking institutions. Now, one of the advantages to Bitcoin is that it allows people to move money around. And one of the things that you talk about in an op-ed you wrote about this is remittances. So what is that term referring to, and how does that relate to Bitcoin in the developing world?
Yeah, remittances are a really important source of income for millions of families all across the globe. Oftentimes, if you live in a developing country like Indonesia or Venezuela, the job opportunities in your home country are not very good. So oftentimes, a member of your family will leave to go to a country like South Africa or the United States, where there are many more jobs and opportunities to make money. And then they'll send money overseas back home to their families. And those are called remittances. But sending money overseas can be incredibly expensive.
Right.
But I think one important thing to understand is how huge a portion of certain economies' remittances are. For example, in Tajikistan, remittances make up 52% of the country's GDP, which is absolutely enormous.
Wow, so half the country's economy consists of people in other countries sending money back to Tajikistan?
Exactly. It's kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah, and we see that a similar situation where in the United States, obviously there's a demand for migrant labor and there's controversy around illegal immigration, but the simple fact is that where there's a supply and a demand, the two things are going to find each other.
Exactly.
And a lot of the people who illegally immigrate to the United States are not trying to really plant a flag and hang out forever. What they're trying to do is make money in U.S. dollars, a relatively strong currency, and then send it back home where it will have way more purchasing power. But as you mentioned, just the fact that they have to send the money back, maybe through Washington Mutual or a money order could be really expensive. So Bitcoin, is it free? I mean, how do people send money through Bitcoin?
Yeah, absolutely. So under the current conventional system, the two biggest players are Western Union and MoneyGram. And as you alluded to, the transaction fees for sending money overseas that way can be incredibly expensive. In some corridors, it's up to 25%. And so if you can imagine 25% of your income you're trying to send back to your family just disappearing as it's being transferred to them, that can be incredibly disenfranchising. But yeah, Bitcoin can pretty much be sent overseas for free. As I mentioned, with cash, there is no intermediary to send Bitcoin through. You just send Bitcoin directly to your family members in that country, and it gets to them with exactly as much amount as you sent to them. The only potential fee you could think about would be the fee from converting Bitcoin into the local currency. But that's usually a fraction of the cost of the typical transaction costs.
So, of course, one of the biggest advantages or one of the hurdles in the developing world is that sending money between where you might be working and where you come from. And Bitcoin can certainly help with that. And with the as we talked about on episode 16 of this podcast, we had Evelyn Smith from AEI to come on the show to talk about just the explosion of growth in the mobile phone market in Africa and mobile internet. So clearly Bitcoin requires some type of internet connection, but the growth of Bitcoin in the developing world, particularly in Africa, is correlating with a general growth of internet access as well. Now, one of the biggest problems in the developing world, as you say, is bad currency. So let's talk about the problem of hyperinflation. The most famous example of this is in post-World War I Germany, where the country's economy was in tatters. They had just lost a war, and the Treaty of Versailles, which ended World War I, many argue was very unfair to Germany, which led to a lot of the horrible things that led to World War II. But really, the image that people have in their minds is a currency that is so worthless that you have to pile stacks and stacks of money into a wheelbarrow to go buy a loaf of bread, right? So that's hyperinflation when your currency is worthless. How does that happen, Caleb? As you say in your op-ed, this is not just a thing that occurs in a vacuum.
Yeah, absolutely. For a lot of our listeners in the United States, they may not be familiar with hyperinflation, since thankfully most of us have never had to experience it.
Right.
And then that's very positive. But lots of central banks and lots of governments are not nearly as responsible as the United States one. One of the most recent examples of this was in Zimbabwe. In their peak inflation in 2008, at one point it was 79 billion% per month, which it equates to prices roughly doubling every 25 hours. So if you can imagine, going to the store one day, you try to buy a loaf of bread for $2, and then you come back the next day and it's $4, and the next day and it's $8 and $16. And it's really unsustainable for an economy. But usually the way hyperinflation happens, it isn't just, appear one day. Usually there's bad fiscal and monetary policy that has happened in the country. Oftentimes, debts are built up, and then the government needs a way of being able to pay back those debts. But rather than trying to cut back on spending, which can often be difficult, if you can just print more money, it can seem like a really easy way of making all your problems disappear.
It's just like magic, right? You run out of money, you print more of it. So what's the problem?
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, as Milton Friedman laid out, when you increase the size of the monetary supply by large amounts, money becomes less less valuable. It costs way more money to be able to buy the same things when the money supply grows exponentially in that way.
And a lot of times people's wages are not going up to meet this. And even if they did, that would just exacerbate the problem, because if they're getting raises every day, their wages are doubling to meet the inflation. It
exactly.
just contributes to the problem where no one sees any value in the currency. So hyperinflation can be extremely devastating. As you mentioned, your op-ed, you've got a country like Zimbabwe with 75% poverty. How can Bitcoin mitigate this problem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So oftentimes when hyperinflation happens to a country, the citizens of the country, they don't just roll over. They start to look for alternatives. One of the most important aspects of a currency is the ability to hold value. So people start looking for alternative sources of holding their value. Oftentimes they like to turn to the United States dollar, to the euro. But especially when the banks are nationalized, like they are in a country like, Zimbabwe or Venezuela, it's way easier to restrict the entry of foreign currencies into the country. And that's where Bitcoin comes in. It's way harder to restrict Bitcoin from being able to come into the country. And even though Bitcoin has experienced some volatility, the volatility it's experienced makes Venezuela look like a dream come true.
So whereas a country like Zimbabwe, their government could easily just write a law that says no US dollars or no euros, or you have to use our currency if we're talking about hard currency or traditional currency in a bank account or something like that. But what you're suggesting is trying to clamp down on Bitcoin in that way wouldn't work because it's decentralized?
Exactly, yeah. If you want to stop dollars from coming into the country, you can never do it completely, but the sources are much more centralized in the way that dollars pour into the country. And because they're a physical entity, it's also easier to stop them that way. But anyone with a mobile phone, anyone with an internet access can easily send Bitcoin to and from all over the world. And so, as John Matonis has stated, he's the a pretty integral member of the Bitcoin Foundation. Bitcoin was made to survive underground. It's really hard and difficult to shut off access to it.
And we take for granted in the United States, the rule of law, stable financial institutions, aside from 2008 when the whole thing almost came crashing down. But clearly there are a lot of countries around the world where those people just don't have those luxuries. So having a decentralized global currency is really good. Now, I read your op-ed, and I guess, this might be a really stupid question, but it's the first one that came to mind. Bitcoin sounds great. It provides a alternative currency to people living in a country like Zimbabwe. But if they're already dealing with the hyperinflation and they don't have the money, so if they're dealing in a Zimbabwe currency, which is worthless, how are they going to go then buy Bitcoin, which is traded on a global market with a global price? I mean, if they can't afford the Bitcoin, then what's the point?
The big problem with hyperinflation is that money becomes worthless after holding it for too long.
Okay.
So if you get your wages and then immediately transfer it into another currency like Bitcoin, then you can avoid that problem.
Oh, so basically the smart thing to do would be, as soon as you get whatever currency you're dealing with, immediately convert it and then only have Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I want to put in a little caveat here. For this to succeed, it requires a little bit of sophistication on the Bitcoin network's part. In order to actually use Bitcoin in a country, that means that the shopkeepers have to accept Bitcoin.
Right.
And that means that you have to have a place where you can bank your Bitcoin. And in the past, with the Russian ruble, when it collapsed in 2013, we saw a big spike in Bitcoin transactions from the ruble into Bitcoin, but they didn't last because they didn't have the underlying infrastructure to be able to maintain Bitcoin as an actual currency use. So I think this is a bit of a mid to long term strategy, but as more and more shops and more businesses begin to accept Bitcoin, and as the economy becomes more globalized, then the chances of Bitcoin being a really great alternative to a country with hyperinflation just continue to increase.
When we talk about developing world and economic growth and the need to have entrepreneurship in a lot of these countries, one of the terms that comes up a lot is microfinance. It's the idea that people like who live in the United States who have some spare cash can invest really tiny sums in entrepreneurs in Africa or other parts of the developing world. And that money will go a really long way to giving those businesses the liquidity they need to invest and to build inventory and things like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's probably not a way that an American who's investing a couple dollars is going to strike gold and become rich. But in many ways, you know, you either break even or you're doing something charitable. You're doing something altruistic. Now, you argue, though, that microfinance, the traditional system, I guess using U.S. dollars and then having that be converted into Zimbabwe currency, that is not exactly taking off at the way that some of the enthusiasts were hoping would. And how would Bitcoin maybe help jumpstart microfinance?
Yeah. So, I mean, microfinance has certainly grown tremendously, you know, during the past 20 to 30 years. There's hundreds of thousands of microfinance institutions all over the world that are providing, you know, small loans for entrepreneurs or for just poor people who need access to cash. But you're right that it hasn't sort of lived up to the promise that microfinance was first advertised as. It was thought, you know, if people could have access to capital, they'd be able to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, and you know, poverty would suddenly start to vanish. But really, the best evidence we have has shown that microfinance hasn't been particularly effective at actually eliminating poverty. But what it has done is it smoothed out poverty, because part of the problem of being poor isn't just how little money you're making, but how infrequently it comes. You know,
right.
you can't know, you know, am I going to have enough money next week to buy food for my family? So what microfinance has done is it's kind of smoothed out the consumption curve. And people can, you know, borrow a little bit when they're in need and then pay it back when their paycheck finally comes in. And that's a really good thing. And I'm really glad that it exists to provide that function. But because the interest rates are so high, the vast majority of microfinance is being used for consumption rather than investment. Typically, microfinance interest loans can range between, you know, 30 to 70% in some locations. And that's way too high to invest in education and long-term business investment, which are the two biggest drivers of actually, you know, reducing poverty.
Right.
So if we could find a way to reduce the interest rates, then that could make microfinance usable for investment rather than just consumption.
And is that where Bitcoin comes in?
Yes, exactly. Good foresight. Bitcoin can really dramatically reduce the transaction fees and the interest fees. As we mentioned earlier with remittances, not only is getting money to the location in the first place much cheaper, but part of the problem that drives interest rates up so high with microfinance is just administering them.
Right.
It takes just as much man hours to administer a $10,000 loan as it does a $100 loan. But then when you're comparing one $10,000 loans with, you know, $100 loans, that's way more manpower. And so the individual interest rate for each small loan is much higher than it would be for a large one. But with Bitcoin and with, you know, a digital currency in general, you can automate a lot of that distribution process, and you can check up and see how good credit do you have? Have you used these microloans responsibly in the past? You can have a unique individual identifier with your Bitcoin wallet that you're using, and we can track to make sure that you're using the money responsibly. And so it can really automate a lot of the time-intensive staff hours that are required to administer microfinance, and in the process, dramatically lower the interest rates.
Well, Bitcoin, virtual currency, cryptocurrency, whatever you call it, it's certainly not going away. It's certainly growing. And, you know, while there is some volatility in the market, it clearly poses a lot of advantages for people who live in, you know, economies where, you know, financial institutions are just not there in the traditional sense, or they live under authoritarian regimes that don't have an incentive to allow competition in currency. And this is really an exciting thing, and we'll certainly be tracking it here on the podcast. But that's it for today's show. My guest has been Caleb Watney, a graduate research fellow at the Mercatus Center, a university-based research center. Caleb, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter at TechFreedom or on Facebook.com/TechFreedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will really help us out, and it will help others find the show. You can check out Caleb's op-ed in the show notes where we link to it. Thank you so much for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.